So thank you for having me here. I'll talk about some work on explaining the fermion masses and mixings in the standard model. This is done with my collaborator, Surjit Rajendran, who's a grad student at Stanford. So to me, standard model flavor presents a really interesting puzzle. UCAL couplings, by virtue of being dimensionless, of course, can be sensitive to physics really deep in the UV. You know, they're some of our few probes, potentially. Of course, you know, what we get ultimately are the values of the fermion masses and mixings and stuff. So I want to take the philosophy that there may be something very interesting to be explained here. In particular, I want to argue that these masses don't really look random. It looks like there's maybe an interesting pattern to them. For example, they're obviously not all order one, so they're not all around the top mass. But maybe, say, even on a log scale, to me, they don't look randomly distributed. And by the way, you can certainly disagree with this philosophy that I'm presenting. In fact, on some days I disagree, and I work on other flavor models. But here, for this talk, I want to argue, say, first of all, even the electron UCAL, none of the UCALs are less than maybe about 10 to the minus 5. And imagine, you know, people played around a lot with extra-dimensional flavor models in RS or even in flat extra dimensions. It's easy to get warped profiles. It's easy to get exponentially small overlaps determining these UCAL couplings. And of course, that's how people have explained the smallness of these numbers. But you know, I want to take kind of a different viewpoint. I want to say, well, none of them are smaller than 10 to the minus 5. And that doesn't really necessarily mean, that doesn't really look to me exponentially small. For example, actually, Raman Sundaram had a paper recently arguing that in these type of extra dimensional models, the best neutrino mass scenario is actually Dirac neutrino masses, because it's so easy to get such incredibly small UCAL couplings out of warping, or out of just warp profiles in extra dimensions. Furthermore, I want to argue that the pattern of these masses don't really look random. You see a hierarchy between each, you know, successive pair of generations in each of these columns here, the up quarks, down quarks, and leptons. Of course, across generations, they can have similar masses, but they don't. In other words, they don't look arbitrarily distributed. Every one of these splittings is somewhere between a factor of 10 to a few hundred. And they seem to come in this generation structure. So I want to argue, I want to take the viewpoint that this is really what needs explaining, almost more than just the overall smallness of the numbers. Since those are technically natural, it may be even the pattern that's the most interesting. So I'll come back to how we do that. I just want to say, we draw a lot of inspiration, so I'll be talking about generating these this pattern radiatively. In a radiative framework. This has got a long history. Many people have worked on this, more than I can list here. The earliest attempt I know about, George and Glashow in 1973, tried to generate the electron mass from the muon. And people have worked in Gotz and in Suzy, and they've had generated some of the mixings and some of the various different components of the masses. I'll be most motivated by this nice work from Patty Fox and Bogdan Dobrescu from last year, where they had a very simple model for generating the up and lepton masses radiatively. I borrowed the name Domino from them, so it's really their cute title. You'll see the details of our model are somewhat different. The mechanism works somewhat differently. We don't have, if you remember their model, we don't have cross links and whatnot. But the spirit is similar, so that's why I'm using the same name. So, okay, I want to begin just by telling you the basic idea, sort of a general framework. Then I want to move on to specifically how we realize this in specific radiative generation models. Then I want to talk about what kind of predictions, or really, of course, postdictions, for the UCAL models make. And then tell you some other possible future experimental signatures and other ways you might go with this basic idea. So the general idea. So we want to generate this interesting pattern of UCAL couplings. And I want to do it all in some simple way. And in fact, I want to add, you know, my philosophy is really, I don't want to make arbitrary choices of, say, the second generation couples in this way while the first generation couples differently or something like that. I have to put the top UCAL on this one brain, the top quark on this one brain while all the others exist on some other brain, or things like that. Those types of choices, those models could be real. That could be the way the world works. But I'm going to demand a little bit more, at least from my point of view. I really want to generate all this interesting pattern from completely democratic treatment of the generations, completely democratic treatment of flavor. So, okay, how do we do it? So I'll start with two arbitrary allowed directions in flavor space. Imagine, I'm going to do a sort of general Spurion analysis. Imagine, though, these are allowed couplings in the Lagrangian. Do we have a laser pointer, by the way? Yeah, great. So two allowed coupling Lagrangian. And my choices will be I'll allow some vector in the 10 space. Oh, I'm always working in SE5 notation, I should say. So remember, the quarks and leptons come in a 10 and a 5 bar. The 10 contains the Q, U, and the E. The 5 bar contains the D and the L of the standard model. So allow some vector in 10 space. And allow some matrix in 10 cross 5 bar space. So these are these two allowed flavor symmetry breaking Spurions. And I'll get into the details of the model in a second, just exactly how I do this. But for now, just let's see what this does, sort of run with this idea. So first, these two Spurions do break all of the U310, U35 bar flavor symmetries that would exist without the Yukawa couplings. Notice I did not just directly allow Yukawa couplings yet, necessarily. And the trick will be, I want to couple only this vector Spurion, only this vector direction to the Higgs. In Spurion language, that's like I charge it under some U1H, which doesn't allow the other things to couple to the Higgs, the other Spurion to couple to the Higgs, just this direction. Then the nice thing is, and I'll tell you how this works, turns out you know, of course, since you have one thing coupled to the Higgs, so I can start generating Yukawa couplings, and I've broken all the flavor symmetries, at some level then, just from allowing these couplings, all the fermion masses and mixings must be generated. All the Yukawa couplings must be generated at some level radiatively. Of course, it's not at all obvious yet that they're going to be generated anything like an interesting pattern. Actually, for example, when we were building these models, much, much easier is to, once you break all the symmetries, they just all get generated at one loop or two loops or something, and they all come in more or less equal but small. But this sort of simple choice of flavor Spurions has this very interesting effect. So,
I'm confused what
mm-hmm.
E on the 10i means.
Sorry. This I is, I should have said. I and J here are generation indices, so they run 1 through 3. So this is all the three generations of 10. And these VI, you know, are literally, I'm literally just imagining VI and MIJ are just arbitrary order 1 allowed numbers. There's arbitrary order 1 couplings in Lagrangian.
So you have a coupling times a single fermion.
Ah, yes, you're going to ask, how am I going to realize that? And that I will get to in a second. But imagine that this Spurion is the only thing that can enter from some UV physics reason, some UV completion of this model that I haven't told you yet, but I will. Imagine this is the only one that can enter. So in other words, every time I'm writing, in other words, what that means outside of Spurion language is every time I'm writing down a 10 by itself, I have to write down this flavor vector with it. And every time I write down a product of a 10 and a 5 bar, I have to write down this flavor vector with it. I'll get to specific models in a second.
The Lorentz symmetry part, but I guess you'll explain that.
Oh, no, yeah. Oh, good. This is not, of course, an actual term in Lagrangian. It's not gauge invariant, for example. Sorry. That's why I didn't write these. These are not actually coming into Lagrangian. Neither of these are gauge invariant. They will be pieces of terms, allowed terms in Lagrangian. But I'm pulling out the important piece here. This is the flavor structure of that piece. You can imagine there's going to be more stuff. Exactly. There's going to be more stuff. But this is the important part. This is what's generating flavor. So I'm just trying to pull out for you here the structure that's giving you the flavor. Yeah, good. Sorry. So I hope that is clear. And you'll see in a specific Lagrangian in a second. But so now in this general language, what does this do? So I start with coupling this direction in 10 space, this V, to the Higgs. So you have one V coupled to Higgs. Notice that I don't choose anything here. Once you allow such a coupling, it just, you know, imagine those are arbitrary order 1 numbers. That just by itself picks one direction in 10 space. Well, that direction, V, I can, of course, choose a basis where I call that the top, or the 10 sub 3. The point is it's just one direction. So far, there's only going to be one direction. So to begin with, there's only one direction that's coupled to the Higgs. So you might think just one direction that starts off by getting a mass. I'll show you in more detail how that works in a second. But what can I say? The basic idea of this model is that starting from this one direction, now I do know all these flavor symmetries are broken. So I have to be able to generate, at some level, every other direction in 10 and in 5 bar space. Yes?
Just
where you're coming from. So B and M are like fields. I mean,
that's right.
Are breaking these symmetries and could eventually have potentials.
Exactly.
Is that somewhere where you're going?
Essentially, you can imagine that would be a UV completion of this. Mm-hmm. Let me see, what's a good thing to say? Yeah, the V actually, I will specifically imagine generating by a field, getting a potential, and getting a VEV. The M, it turns out, I'll just imagine just allowing such a coupling with one more field in it in Lagrangian, and so you just, since I won't talk about, say, the stringy or whatever the UV completion of this would be, I just imagine these are arbitrary order one numbers that just come out from having this coupling be allowed by the symmetry of the theory. But they will always, in fact, come associated with fields, which is an important point. So how will I generate more directions from this one 10 direction I've got to begin with? This won't do it, so I need to use my one other thing that chooses a flavor direction in the standard model, this M. So if I start throwing in the M spurion, the first thing I can do, multiply M dagger times V. You can see, of course, that picks out a vector now and moves the V from 10 to 5 bar space, so it picks out a vector in 5 bar space, but just one. That's the crucial, that right there is the sort of crucial idea of this model. If I start with just one vector in 10 space, I have this completely arbitrary matrix. But at this order, in assertions of M and V, it only picks one direction in 5 bar space. I'll choose a basis, call that the top, or call that the B tau, or the 5 bar 3. Now, of course, I can get to all the other orders. I know that because all the symmetries are broken, but I have to insert more of these spurions. And every insertion is going to cost me some insertions of these fields. And so, you can already see how I do this ratatively. So imagine, first, if I insert one more M spurion, it goes to some MM dagger V, now back in 10 space, so over here on the left. That picks one more direction. In general, it's a different direction from the first direction because this M is an arbitrary matrix. So that picks a charm direction, or a 10-2 direction, let's call it. Let's choose the basis, so that's what it's called. But now you can see what's going to happen. Actually, you can sort of already see why it's a ratative flavor model. If this M always comes associated with some new field, if the term that I'm allowing Lagrangian has some new field here along with the M, then every time to insert an M, it costs me also an insertion of this field. Well, if I want to renormalize the Yukawa couplings, if I want to generate Yukawa couplings, those fields need to not be there. They need to close off into loops, for example. So if you think of every M as an insertion of a field, you can see an M and an M dagger can loop off together and make a loop. And that's what will cost you. That's the factor that will cost you for insertion of these spurions, essentially, is a loop factor. And I'll get to that more in just a second. But so you can see, at this order, in two insertions of the spurion, I've only generated two directions in 10 space. But obviously, I can go on inserting more of these spurions and generate all the remaining directions in 10 and 5 bar space, you know, at 3, 4, and 5 insertions of this M spurion. And so I just want to say, in this language, then, what does a mass look like? So a mass, of course, or Yukawa coupling, like H1010, is two directions in 10 space. It's got, you know, one vector here and one vector here. I haven't put the I indices on them, but you know, that's how you can think of a matrix or whatever, right? So to begin with, at that leading order, you only pick two directions in 10 space, V cross V. That's a top mass. That's populating, if you like, the 3-3 element of this Yukawa coupling. This is the general idea. I have not shown you yet a specific model that realizes this, but this is what I'll be shooting for when I do build models. Similarly, then, what's a charm mass? Well, of course, you have to pick the 2-2 direction in this Yukawa space. So I need to have the charm, MM dagger V, cross the charm. That costs me, I'll put one epsilon factor arbitrarily. That'll be my rule for every insertion of MM dagger. And again, you'll see where this calculation of epsilon comes in a real model. That tells you how to calculate the spurion factors. But here you can see I'm starting to generate the charm mass at order epsilon squared. I need more of these spurions. And in fact, of course, there's something in the middle. If I use on the left a charm and on the right a top, so just two insertions of the spurion, I get some top charm mixing term, which of course just has one epsilon and goes in these off-diagonal elements here. And so you can already start to see a nice pattern that I'm generating. I'm generating the mixing angles in the standard model at intermediate order, epsilon order, whereas the mass hierarchy was epsilon squared, intermediate order between the masses, and this is sort of phenomenologically a kind of famous parameterization that works pretty well. So that's already one nice thing I'm getting out of this, very simple, just using these two spurions. Also, of course, I'm getting hierarchies in the masses. And you can see I can go on doing this and populate the entire rest of the up Yukawa matrix. in this way, and I get this nice 1 epsilon squared epsilon to the fourth pattern that seems to pretty nicely reproduce those up quark Yukawa masses, the up quark masses that I was showing you. And similarly, you get mixing angles. Now, of course, I also want to talk about downs and leptons, so we can understand from the Spurian analysis where their masses should come in if I build a model of this. So a B tau mass is really the third, you know, generation in the 10 sector, and then the third generation in the 5 bar sector. That's what populates this 1 here. So I insert a V cross an M dagger V. That's the B tau mass. And because that only has 1 M, I'm just calling it delta here. You'll see in a second in a real model what these delta and epsilon factors actually are. But in general, it's a somewhat different Spurian, somewhat different factor than this epsilon, which is just interesting. But of course, then, this exact same mechanism goes through. I just insert MM daggers everywhere, and I can generate all the other masses and mixings in the down sector. And of course, I generate them with exactly the same very nice pattern from a phenomenological point of view. You sort of naturally generate these interesting hierarchies. And this right here is basically, this is the important idea in the model. I'll show you in the specific model in a second. But this is really what's going on. This is the flavor direction. In fact, you can see it doesn't actually really have anything to do necessarily with radiative generation. I could come up with other specific models that realize this general Spurian structure can generate for me these nice Yukawa matrices that I want. So actually, I'll speculate a little at the end. We were trying to build some extra dimensional models even, and some other models. But you know, the really important point is that from two completely arbitrary directions in flavor space, one vector in the 10 space, one matrix in 10 cross 5 bar space, but total just arbitrary order 1 numbers. I didn't have to make choices like this number is bigger than this other number. You get hierarchies. And in fact, you generate all the masses and all the mixings you want at a very nice order. You get these nice hierarchies. That's the essential idea. It's sort of pretty simple, which is why I like it. It's a pretty simple way to generate all, you know, 9 masses, 3 mixings in 1 phase. Okay, but so now I want to tell you in some detail, actually, how do we do this? And of course, even though the Spurian analysis was simple, it would be nice to see that I can actually generate this in a reasonably simple UV framework. Otherwise, you maybe wouldn't believe it so much. So, to begin with, I'm going to generate these masses radiatively. So start by forbidding all Yukawa couplings. This is sort of the standard starting point, except allowing, of course, the two Spurians, the two directions that I want in flavor space. So imagine introducing some new vector-like pair of fields, phi and phi bar, and allowing these two couplings in the superpotential. Again, I'll always talk in SU5 gut notation. So I allow an H up 10-10 coupling. This is Higgs up. And a coupling to the 10 phi bar, a phi of the phi bar. At this level, the phi can either be a 5 or a 45 of SU5. That's what couples here. And I won't say yet, but you should actually imagine if they're 45s, these fields can be new. I'll show you in a second. If they're 5s, these 5s can actually just be the Higgses that we already have. So that's sort of getting ahead of myself. Now, what do I need? I need these to be my flavor Spurians. So this is the simpler one. Just consider this for a second. I just need this to be an allowed coupling. I'll have some, whatever, U1, some discrete symmetry that forbids the Yukawas. But just allow this. Okay, so it's allowed. It's order 1. You get some arbitrary order 1 matrix here with, the, you know, these have the MIJ flavor directions between the 10 and the 5 bar. Okay, so that's it. I just allow this coupling. That's simple to understand. What about this? Well, this is what I need, right? I haven't shown you how to get this yet, but I need it to only be, this 10 direction has to be V, this other 10 direction needs to be the same direction. I need to not pick different directions in 10 space, or I just far too rapidly generate all the masses once I'm picking multiple directions. Okay, so how do I get that? How do I realize this? This is the flavor structure I need for my model. How do I realize it? And so hopefully this answers the question about this is the actual allowed coupling. It's not a V10, of course. It's the normal, you know, gauge invariant, Lorentz invariant, H up 10-10, but it needs to only point in the V cross V direction. Does that make sense now? Is that okay? Just so I don't have to keep writing V cross V, I always call V the third generation, so it's really an H up 10-3, 10-3. At this level, of course, since I haven't told you how to get it yet, it might look like I was violating my own philosophy, that I was just picking a direction. I was saying, well, this just has to point in one direction. It just can't be an arbitrary matrix. This one can be. So an important thing is to show you how this can be generated. But we do know, if I can generate this, that this coupling breaks the U3 on the 10s down to a U2, where you just rotate the lighter two generations, the other two generations, and this breaks all the remaining flavor symmetries. And so, of course, then the important point is that all the eukaryotic couplings will be generated some order. In fact, we saw they should fall right in that successive hierarchical order that we saw from the Spurian analysis. But before I get to that, how do I UV complete this top coupling? What mechanism generates this HF 10-3, 10-3? So there's actually probably a couple ways. Many people have had come up with models that only give the top of mass. But since I want something that's sort of arbitrary in flavor, this is the simplest way to do it. So again, I'm forbidding all my Yukawas. But now, imagine I introduce one new particle, essentially a new vector-like 10 n multiple. N for new. And instead of allowing the H up to couple to the tens, the families of the standard model, I don't allow that at all. I only allow it to couple to this one new direction. This one new, you can think of it as a heavy vector-like fourth generation or something. So I just allow this coupling. Here's one example of a U1 symmetry that can realize it. Actually, there's a whole bunch. I think there's two linearly independent sets of symmetries. So anyway, I just allow this H up 10-10. So that is this coupling here in this diagram. And then I just allow a coupling directly between the tens of the standard model and this new 10, or the 10 bar, and some singlet. And because the whole trick here is you only introduce one new field. One new field means that these are just completely arbitrary order one numbers in front of this coupling here, this term Lagrangian. Notice this only picks one direction in 10 space. That's all it can do. You just have a single 10 field, a single standard model field. So that's this vertex here. And I'm going to imagine the S then is the thing which gets a potential and gets a VEV one way or another. In fact, the S, of course, is exactly what's spontaneously breaking this PQ symmetry that will eventually, the PQ symmetry is what's forbidding the actual Yukawas of the standard model. The S breaking it is what triggers all of it to eventually be generated radiatively. So you can see that I've allowed this diagram. And the crucial, important part of this diagram, the crucial trick, was that now H up couples to 10-3 on one side and the exact same 10-3 on the other side because it's the exact same coupling. It's very easy to fail at this. Many models we made that weren't even this simple, actually. Generally, the problem was essentially you'd introduce two directions in 10 space. So the crucial point is to keep yourself just to one direction in 10 space and use the exact same coupling, and then you get this relatively simple model. So the cost of just introducing one new vector-like 10. You can see then this sort of Frog and Nielsen-style mechanism diagram generates for you an H up 10-3, 10-3, without me having to choose the top of these special or charge it differently under some flavor symmetry or whatever. It's just all the generations treated the same way. But it's H up, coupling to some direction in the tens, just at the order of the VEV squared over the mass of this new field. And so long as I just assume they're about the same order, which seems natural, you get about the right top Yukawa. So that's how you start off. And then this will be the simple model that I'm starting off with. And this will essentially generate what I need. Okay? So how does that work? How does it actually happen? How do we realize the Spurianic idea that we had in the beginning? Here is the leading order diagram that'll generate something for you, an up mass for you, that besides the top. So you can see I start with a top coupling, and then I have a two-loop diagram with you pass these five R's around. You know I'm going to need to use this other Spurion. And in fact, as this turns out, this can take you down to a charm mass, but in fact, it shouldn't be at all surprising, because what is this? Well, each of these vertices is nothing more than my Spurion M. So if you just read down the line here, what direction have I generated? I've generated M, M dagger, V. On each side, M, M dagger, V. So of course, we know what that is. We recognize that. That's the charm mass, right? This is what I said the charm mass would look like, M, M dagger, V cross M, M dagger, V. So this two-loop diagram can exactly generate for you a charm mass, but of course, you know from my Spurian analysis, what it cannot do is generate an up mass. Right, that's the important point. Okay, I generated some more of the charm mass radiatively, the second generation 10 mass radiatively, but so often these models fail because they actually generated all of the masses. Once you broke the symmetries, the flavor symmetries, they generated all of the masses at the same order, radiatively. But you just know from the Spurian analysis that this cannot do that. It cannot do that because, same reason, MM dagger V is only one more direction in 10 space. So until I insert more of these Spurions, I can't go beyond just giving mass to two generations.
Right, for a single phi couples like a mass like a can be rotated away.
This graph. Good. Well, it can't. Of course, in some sense, it can be rotated away. But if it gives a kinetic mixing, Exactly. So let's say I just insert two of these spuri on MM dagger. Well, they loop off into a one-loop kinetic mixing for the tens. This one-loop kinetic mixing can mix generations. In other words, it picks out, if I imagine putting this vertex here, so this is correcting the top Yukawa, then there's a 10-3 on one side, the V direction on one side, but there's the MM dagger V on the other side. And that, of course, is exactly the top charm mixing that I wanted at one loop. So in other words, when I rotate it out of the kinetic terms, it goes into the Yukawa terms and gives me the mixing. Or just another way to say, you know, this causes beta, you know, running in the off-diagonal elements. And so then we've realized exactly what we wanted. We've realized a way to generate this hierarchical up-quark Yukawa matrix just from this simple model here, these two simple directions in flavor space. Okay. Now what about the down and lepton masses? For that, it's not obvious from what I've told you so far. Those actually wouldn't be generated yet. There's some U1 remaining acting on the Higgs's and the Phi's such that you couldn't actually couple the Higgs yet. That's okay, because I'm going to need to add some Susie breaking anyway. So the simplest model we found, add a Susie breaking B-mu term between phi and phi bar. I kind of wrote this wrong. You should think of the phi, really, it's very similar to a Higgs. So the phi will have whatever couplings the Higgs has. In fact, if the phi is a 5, not a 45, it actually is the Higgs. If it's a 45, it just has whatever coupling the Higgs has. The 45 couples a very similar way, although with one subtlety that I'll get to in a second. But what does this allow? If I add this this one term, then I can draw diagrams like this, one-loop diagrams. This is the leading order, where again you see I use this 10-3, 10-3, the two V directions, Higgs up. And from it, I can just use one of my flavor direction. I'm just focusing here on things that change flavor, things that are important for flavor directions. And so this, at one loop, generates the V cross my M dagger V, which is my B tau mass. You remember from my spurion analysis, this is one direction in 10 space and one direction in 5 bar space. In other words, the use of the spurion analysis is just to prove to you that at this order, where I just insert one of these flavor spurions, in fact, any diagram that just inserts one flavor breaking spurion M, cannot generate anything but a single B tau mass. It cannot generate the other generations. That's essentially, again, that's the basic idea. Of course, I can then, by more insertions of the M coupling, generate from this all the other masses and mixings. So for example, this vertex here, now this little dot stands for this whole diagram here. And then at two more loop order, at two more insertions of these M and M dagger, you can see I can go from this, which is just a B tau mass, and generate, well, you know, a strange mu mass, second generation mass. So this would be populating this, you know, epsilon squared component of this matrix here. Again, you know, this delta now, you can see what it stands for, by the way. It stands for this one loop diagram, which is a little bit different from these diagrams, and I'll show you how to calculate them in a second. But once I have this bottom tau mass, once I start off the chain, all the rest of it, this whole matrix gets populated in the exact same way, really the same diagrams, essentially. So to recap, I've now told you how to generate these masses, and the basic idea of the model works like this. This is my model. I start with just one top Yukawa, one top mass at tree level. Right? Then I have that one loop diagram with one insertion of this M spurion, which generates for me a B tau mass. And we know at this order, if I only insert one of the M's, I know I can't generate any of the other masses. If I then allow myself to, go to the next order, insert more of the MM daggers, at two loop order through this cross diagram, I generate from the top, I can generate the second generation charm. From the B tau, I can generate the second generation strange mu. But you know, that's it. In other words, the mass matrix still has the determinant zero. You know, I have not generated all non-zero eigenvalues because of the thing I told you. You haven't picked out enough directions in flavor space yet to populate the entire Yukawa matrix. So only finally at the next order, when I insert more of these MM daggers, you know, use this loop diagram again if you like. Actually, there's a lot of loop diagrams in this order, which is why it gets complicated, which is why I'm telling it to you in the spurion analysis. But that's how you can be sure that I haven't missed a diagram. Even if I miss a diagram, it doesn't matter. You know at what order it has to be generated, and it's yet another order until you finally get masses for the first generation. And the interesting thing, of course, is that this pattern looks kind of similar to the pattern I showed you at the beginning. The ups are nicely, in each column, things are nicely hierarchically split. The B tau, well, you know, from, you know, SE5 works pretty well, so these are pretty well unified, and they're below the top, etc. So we're kind of getting some of the qualitative features that we wanted from this pretty simple
set of directions
in flavor space. So now just to say finally, specifically, what's my minimal model? So if the phi and phi bar are the five and five bar, or fives and five bars of SU5, then you might as well just use the Higgs instead. Don't add any new fields at all, actually, beyond the supersymmetric standard model particle content. Even if you did add new fields, they would kinetically mix anyway, so it really doesn't matter. So then to say more simply, what I've got is I've got this top Yukawa and this spurion M. But of course, the crucial point, this should be clear, I don't want the H up will be the Higgs which breaks electroweak symmetry by getting a VEV. H down needs to be somewhat uncoupled from it, you can see, so I don't just generate order one masses with my spurion. In other words, I did not want to connect my spurion to the Higgs VEV, to the electroweak symmetry breaking VEV. So if you like, what I need to do is either not have a very large B mu term between these Higgses, in other words, I need to take a large tan beta limit to say it in MSSM language. Of course, I told you, this you might think already is a problem. In fact, we thought for a little while it was a problem. Because I needed that B mu term. I needed that B mu term to start off the down and lepton sector to give the B tau a mass. It turns out, and this is kind of the really nice thing that I like, if you just ask for a B mu term between the triplets, so some double triple splitting mechanism, for example, and I should say, I won't have anything better to say about this. This is, it's a general problem of guts to get heavy mass terms between the triplets that aren't between the doublets. I don't think I have any better mechanism. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it could, for example, even be a tuning, right? Just so we're clear. But if we do that, the nice thing, which isn't totally obvious, is that, starting from an H up 10 3 10 3, you're only interested in when the doublet connects to this, only the doublet Higgs, I should have written a 2 here, only the doublet Higgs that gets a VEV. So the doublet Higgs only has one connection, only connects to QU in standard model language now. The 10 also has an E in it, but it does not connect to the E, so it's the only one it's got. So you might be worried, can I generate both the B and the tau mass now that I've explicitly broken SU5? But the nice thing, the sort of cute thing that makes this model work, is that I can, because I have two choices for where to put, which direction, essentially. I can either put QU or UQ. And the difference is, if I flip them, it routes color differently around this interior loop here. So in one case, this becomes a QD, a bottom mass. In the other case, it becomes an EL, a tau mass. And that's just because of the way color is flowing around this loop here.
You have this relation at a very small VEV in order that didn't directly generate.
Yeah, exactly. So a very large tan beta, 10 to the 5 or something, right? In order to keep the electron. Yeah, exactly. So that's an aesthetic cost. Well, let's see. It depends what you mean by possible. I mean, it's possible with a tuning at the very worst. What can I say? I mean, I won't have a better approach to double triple splitting, I think, so. But yeah, but that, I mean, it's an important point, though, to make, which is I do think that it is at this level an aesthetic cost, for sure. But it's nice because it allows you to be very minimal and not use any new fields beyond the supersymmetric standard model particle content, just write a couple terms and flavor directions. Okay. oh, and there's another interesting point. If I do this, notice this is explicitly SE5 breaking. Which can actually be very good because the down leptons do not have the exact same masses, even at the gut scale. So you can see these terms, although you're able to generate both these, it'll turn out they won't be exactly the same, and that turns out to be give some very interesting predictions, which I'll show you the numbers in a second, but it can actually be useful for getting the actual masses we observe. So, but sort of for completeness, I want to also explore the possibility that it could be a 45. So, of course, in SU5 language, the 10 cross a 5 bar is a 5 plus a 45, so that's why this phi could either have been a 5 or a 45. And in case you don't know, the 45 is got two upper anti-symmetric indices and one lower index with a traceless condition. However, and it's not obvious when just from the index structure, but it turns out that this is going to have a problem. So first of all, just by allowing this coupling, which is certainly allowed, I get every link in the chain that I need, every step, except the first step. I don't get the B tau mass yet. To get the B tau mass, I'm going to need a coupling like phi 10 3 10 3 to make that one loop diagram. Well, it turns out, it's not obvious, but it turns out the 45 is the anti-symmetric combination of two 10s, which means that these are the same field, which is critical, right? We needed this to be just one generation, one direction. This coupling is zero. Okay, so I can't get around. I mean, we know at some level I should be able to generate these spurions. It's going to make the model a little bit uglier. So that's the sort of aesthetic cost of the 45s. The model we created, which works, is, remember how UV completed this HUP 10.3, 10.3 with some Frog and Nielsen style diagram? So instead of just adding one new 10, new vector-like 10, I add two. You know I'm going to need two because I need the 45 to couple the two different fields. Of course, the critical thing, I said that one was a nice trick because that's what picked that there was only one direction in flavor space. So I'm going to have to preserve that somehow. And the way we do it, the way we figure out how to do it, is, okay, so couple this phi, or the Higgs up, whichever, to 10N1, 10N2, the two different new fields now. You know, previously, these were both the same, 10N. And of course, when they were the same, they could on either side both pick the same direction. They did pick the same direction in 10 space. Now, though, imagine I only couple one of the sides to this S. So this side picks a direction in 10 space. This other side just doesn't get coupled. That's sort of the trick. That it turns out I can even use that coupling in my diagram, passing here now, not starting directly from the top Yukawa, which is there but not useful for this diagram, but starting from this 10.3, 10N2 coupling, going through a phi, it can again become a B tau mass. This would be a phi bar 3 here. So what can I say? This is a little uglier for sure. First of all, I think most of us would say there's probably sort of an aesthetic cost if you're using a representation as big as a 45. I don't know how to evaluate that. But also here, I did need to use more fields, so just keep that in mind. I will explore it though because it gives interesting and somewhat different numerical results. Kind of at the very detailed level, the qualitative level works the same way. But when I get into the ugly details and exactly how to fit the masses. Now, also, I should say, so far, from the qualitative picture I showed you, there's no reason this had to pick actually a scale to happen at all. All these diagrams are log divergent. These are all one loop and two loop log divergences. So they can happen in really any scale. It's the usual story with flavor. It can be generated anywhere. But, sort of, unfortunately, both the 5 and the 45 both turn out, if they couple in this way, to a 10 phi bar. They both have proton decay causing components when you break into the standard model components. The 5, obviously, it's the triplet, and the 45 has, I think, 3 proton decay causing components out of the 7 things that it breaks up into. So, therefore, I know phi has to get a mass at the gut scale to avoid fast proton decay. This would induce a dimension 6 proton decay operator. So if phi gets a mass below the gut scale, the proton will decay too quickly. Obviously, there is a caveat to that. I mean, I could project out the components of these that are causing proton decay. If I project out the triplet of the 5, the model won't work, right? Because I said I needed the triplet. Actually, it turns out, even if I did have a BMU term for the doublet, that the doublet is not able to do this cute trick of generating both the bottom and the tau together. So you really needed the triplet there. You can project out the 3 components of the 45 that cause proton decay, and the remaining 4 components are enough to generate all the masses and mixings. They'll have some SU5 breaking relations between them, which might be interesting. But if you do that, you spoil unification anyway if you put it at low energy. So to me, it loses motivation. You could do that, but it loses motivation. So I'm going to imagine that I'm doing all this at the gut scale. Phi gets a mass at the gut scale, my new particle's at the gut scale, and all this flavor generation happens at the gut scale. of course, then I need this Susie breaking BMU term in the phi sector, right? Even if these phis were new fields, I need the Susie breaking to be at the gut scale because otherwise the diagram would be suppressed by the size of BMU compared to the masses of the phi or whatever that's running in the loop. So I really need that BMU to be around the gut scale. I need all these mass scales to be around the gut scale. I guess these could be a little higher. These are the ones that generate the top Yukawa. There's no reason. These could also happen at some higher scale. For simplicity, imagine everything's order 1 times the gut scale. But Susie breaking in this phi sector, it's going to feed into the standard model through loops, if nothing else. So that means that I must be working in high-scale split Susie, where the scalars take masses up near the gut scale. It's sort of annoying. This is not at all related to the flavor structure. This is not at all related to the flavor spurions, choosing the right directions, and the fact that, at every order you only get one more direction. That was an all entirely separate idea. This just comes because of the particular representations I chose for my loop fields that are doing, for the spurion field, essentially. So it's sort of frustrating that it had to happen at the gut scale and I had to work in split Susie. In fact, we have a few ideas they're not as minimal, they're not quite as simple, but a few ideas how you could change this around and actually make that same idea work, that same Spurion idea work, but at low scales, it'll be a rather different model, an SF10 model. But for now, the simplest minimal thing I found is to take this model that I presented and have flavor be generated near the gut scale. I should say, of course, that that may be where flavor is generated anyway, since we've done a lot of looking for flavor effects in colliders, and we've ruled out operators up to 1,000 or 10 to the 4 TeV now, so it's hard to generate flavor near the weak scale anyway. With my model now, what do we get out for the Yukawa couplings? How do the numbers actually work? We know they're going to work roughly right, but how about in detail? So you can calculate all these loops. Actually, you don't even have to look too specifically at the details of the numbers. But so here I'm calculating the color factors. Each of these loops is log divergent. The color factors work out to be what you'd expect, around 5 or so for SE5. Actually, an important point, sort of technical point, this two-loop diagram, this, of course, goes like a single log. This two-loop diagram also only goes like a single log because the divergences here are overlapping. You can see that these two loops, the divergences overlap. So it's, again, only a single log. This is log divergent. And kind of the only thing I really want you to take away is it turns out the size of these wave function normalizations are bigger. The color factors can be bigger, but also because they go like a log per loop factor, per 1 over 16 pi squared, and this only goes like a log for two loop factors, the wave functions can dominate. But keep in mind that this is not actually the biggest effect on the masses. Wave function normalizations do not, if you start with a determinant zero mass matrix, put in any z you want from the kinetic term, you cannot generate a non-zero determinant for your mass matrix. And it's, you know, it's pretty clear to see why. Essentially, when you take the z out of the kinetic term, it comes in multiplying the mass term. So your new mass, you know, once you've rotated to a diagonal kinetic basis, your new mass term is some root z times your old mass matrix. Well, the determinant of a product is a product of determinants, so it still has determinant zero. So ultimately, that's just a way of showing that although these things can affect and do affect mixings primarily, you might think they have the biggest effect on masses, but they do not, because you know they must be normalizing the mass proportional to itself, proportional to whatever is generating, which here is this two-loop diagram. All that means is that when I show you on the next slide, or the next, I guess, two slides from now, that I'm just estimating this two-loop diagram, you'll understand why. I just say, really, we did the full calculation. There's another detailed point, but it turns out to be interesting, which is why I'm showing it to you, which is there are more diagrams. Those diagrams are just sort of heuristic, but once you start getting to three loop and beyond order, there's a bunch more diagrams depending on how you connect. Now, you don't have to worry, like I said, that I missed something, because you know at what level the masses and mixings can be coming in, how many spurions, how many vertices I have to insert of this M. The specific, you know, numbers, the size of that spurion, the dimensionless number in front of it, can be affected by how many diagrams there are and what they take, what form they take. So it turns out, interestingly enough, at the two-loop order, where I generated the top, the B tau, and the charm, just those single diagram I showed you for each of those. But at the three-loop order, where I start generating the new strange mass, you get two more diagrams that are important. And just focus, for example, on this one. You know, this one replaces the diagram where essentially this connected to here and this spurion connected to here. So I just flop these two. It's, of course, the same order in M's. It turns out these color factors can be somewhat larger than the other color factors, and in general, they also add. And for our minimal model, they have explicit SU5 breaking effects. So these turn out to be very important. In particular, because they're adding in and also with somewhat larger color factors, they tend to give a somewhat smaller hierarchy between the downs and leptons, which is where they show up first. Remember, you know, the splitting between the B, the third generation down and the second generation down, is somewhat smaller than the splitting between the top and the charm. That's, you know, one of these sort of famous phenomenological facts people have noticed. This goes in the right direction for that, essentially because the downs come in at one more loop order. Every ratio of downs, like third generation to second, comes in at one more loop order than at the ups. You have more diagrams, and they can even have bigger color factors. So this tends to shrink the hierarchy between the downs and leptons more than between the ups. So that's useful. In fact, you'll see in a second, it shrinks it enough that it's even close then to just order one factors that can explain the difference. Because that would otherwise be sort of a challenge, I should say, for any model that generates it really rigorously in generation steps. The steps seem to be smaller in the downs and leptons. I want to get to showing the explicit numbers for how well it works. So if we just count parameters for a second, You can see I've got, so this is my M is my flavor symmetry breaking spur around here. And the symmetry remaining after I've chosen this top Yukawa is a U2 on the 10s, rotating the other two generations, and a U3 on the 5 bars, which means that I can put the matrix in this sort of upper triangular form, or we call it a staircase form. You can see that because this U3 on the 5 bars removes all of these zeros, makes all of these zero here. You can choose the bases correctly. Of course, if this was a U3 on the 10s, you know, it's a famous result, I can diagonalize this matrix. But it's not a U3 on the 10s, which means I can only rotate the first two generations, which means the only freedom I have is to put a zero here, say. Now, obviously, this is an arbitrary choice of bases, but I make this because it's the most similar to mass bases, you'll see in a second. It's the most similar to the bases that we've been working in, essentially, and the bases that will be the mass bases for the quarks. Just to see that this is really just the language I was just telling you. You know, if you start with a 10-3 and you insert one insertion of this M, you can see because of this zero here, it cannot go to a 5-bar 2. It also can't go to a 5-bar 1. All it can go is to a 5-bar 3. That's another way of saying why at one loop order you only got the B tau mass and you didn't get the other lighter generation down mass. Just the way of saying it in this basis. Then when I insert one more M, because of this non-zero element here, the 5 bar, it could go to the 10-3. That's just a one-loop correction of the 10-3-10-3 coupling, so we don't care. But it can also go to the 10-2. And of course, that's why you get one more direction picked. This zero is why you don't get third direction picked. Okay, so that's just the basis way, you know, saying in this basis. The nice thing about this basis is I have, you know, fewer numbers, so I can show you exactly what these parameters are. In fact, you might count. How many parameters do I have? I have this one here, one arbitrary order, one number. I have 5 here, right? And the nice thing about removing all these symmetries and picking the spaces is I can really say these are 5 real numbers. And finally, I have one parameter here. So that's 7 parameters. Even just in the quark sector alone, there are 6 masses, 3 mixings, and 1 phase. So you might think I have exact mathematical predictions. Okay. However, fortunately or unfortunately, however you look at it, I do not, because of course I'm doing this at high scales. So I can't, forget the effect of higher dimension Planck suppressed operators. I'm working in the effective theory here, I'm not calculating all the stringy corrections, so I just sort of have to admit that there could be arbitrary order one numbers in front of all these Planck slop operators, as I'll call them. And let's just talk about, let's focus on this one here for a second. You can see, this S is the field that got the VEV to break the symmetry that was forbidding the Yukawas. So the operator that I generated, remember the operator I generated to allow this top Yukawa was an S over M gut squared, it's an S squared over M gut squared essentially. Okay, that was great, that gave me my order one top. Now this is a higher dimension operator though, S squared H up 10-10, so of course since I had to generate it, that needed to be allowed in my theory no matter what. It's allowed by this U1 symmetry and all the gauge symmetries, so it can also be generated with arbitrary order one numbers with a one over M Planck squared here. Well, these can have arbitrary flavor indices now. They don't have to point in this direction 10-3. So this is a contribution, just a completely democratic, you know, contribution to all of the up quark masses, if you like, all the up quark Yukawas. Similarly, all the rest of these basically generate gut over Planck squared effects. Or I should say, I can be careful enough to forbid anything that is higher than this. Well, you know, it's kind of an interesting statement. What is gut over Planck squared? It's somewhere between 10 to the minus 5 and 10 to the minus 6 or so. So these look like a lot more parameters. They don't actually matter for any of the heavier fermions. They don't really affect the Yukawa couplings. Of course, what can they affect? They can affect the lightest generation. So these contribute equally with all the other contributions of the first generation masses and the CP phase. Actually, since these can have arbitrary phases in them, if I choose this basis, these don't have any phases in them, so these have arbitrary phases. The basis independent way of saying it is that I can generate a Jarls-Kog invariant, and it turns out if you just put in arbitrary order one phases, like you might expect, you get about the right Jarls-Kog invariant. That's not too surprising. We kind of know the standard model is sort of maximally CP violating. There's an arbitrary order one phase in the Yukawas. And further, you shouldn't be surprised, even though these are small numbers, and they can only contribute to the first, they can only really make a difference for the first generation, famously we know thanks to the Nobel Prize this year, that you only get a CP violation in a three-generation model anyway. So the fact that you didn't have any CP violation or any complex numbers in the heavier two generations in the Yukawa coupling really didn't matter. Just giving it to the first generation is enough. It's just an arbitrary choice of basis. So I lose exact predictions. Actually, at this level, I haven't, I still have the SU5 symmetric relations between the downs and leptons. So I still have the prediction that, you know, the B is equal to the tau and so on.
You want the Planck slop, uh-huh, which could be maximally CP violated?
Yeah, say. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I need that. I need that. But you know, the way I would say it is sort of all the 13 Yukawa couplings are predicted at more or less order one. I mean, in other words, I'm predicting the framework and the rough size of each of these, even with this Planck slab. Okay, so now what about specific numbers? Well, I already told you. This is the diagram that generated the top, and the top, you know, goes to get the top about right, to get the top Yukawa 1, I just need these scales to be more or less the same. So the dimensionless ratio just needs to be an order 1 number, quite close to order 1, very close to 1. What about the other masses? So they're generated by this two-loop diagram, which I can estimate as, actually I've calculated as, some color factor over 16 pi squared squared, times these four products of the couplings that come in 1z at each vertex here, as I've called them. Remember, that's what I was calling the couplings in the M. And then it's log divergent. Like I said, it's only a single log because it's an overlapping divergence. So it goes like some cutoff squared over the mass of the phi field, if we imagine that's the heaviest particle in the loop because these are fermions, the standard model fermions. This cutoff is actually generated by two effects. First of all, this vertex here, this top Yukawa, is this diagram, right? So when the momenta get high enough, when they start to probe, when they get order the mass scale MN that's in the middle of this diagram here, this no longer becomes log, this vertex opens up, and it no longer becomes a log divergent diagram. You know, in other words, you're probing the guts of this. This, you can't just integrate that out and call it some coupling in the effective theory. So that's one that provides one cutoff for the log, also the Suzy breaking scale. You know, Suzy, of course, cuts out these loops. So anyway, one way or another, this is some log divergent cutoff. You know, the IR divergence cutoff by the mass of the phi. The UV divergence is cut off by either of those effects. I'll just assume this log to be an order one number. I think I picked four to illustrate the numbers here. So I don't have a very big ratio of scales. Actually, it turns out you can estimate the diagram this way. Actually, after a very long calculation, you know, I hit enter in Mathematica, thought for a very long time doing all the Feynman integrals. It truly came out with one in front of this. So your estimate is pretty good, not too surprisingly. But I could have saved myself some work. So I should also say, of course, I've only calculated the leading log divergent piece of these diagrams. They do have finite pieces, and since I'm not taking a huge log, those could actually be relevant. I'm not going to go through and calculate all of them for all the loop orders, so I'm only going to estimate the leading log divergent pieces. So that can, you know, produce some slop in the numbers I'm about to tell you. Well, okay, now if we just look at the numbers. So it turns out charm over top and up over charm, the mass ratios are both about 400, 500. This is at the gut scale. So I'm quoting all these masses run up to the gut scale now. So those ratios are 4 or 500. You can see this 1 over 16 pi squared squared is about 10 to the minus 4. You have a color factor of a few. You have a log factor of a few. So long as this four products of couplings, the entire z to the fourth is just some order 1 number, which means really I should have taken the fourth root of these. So it's some number very close to 1. I get just exactly the hierarchy I wanted, which means that these Yukawas are working quite well with really just order one numbers. So this is, you know, a check. This really does seem to be generating the pattern that we observe, almost working better than it had a right to. Now the downs, like I said, the downs won't work quite as well because the splittings are somewhat smaller, though there are these new diagrams. So let's go and estimate those. So first, that we start off with the one loop diagram that gives you the B tau mass from the top. This diagram is a little bit different. It's log divergent, so some 1 over 16 pi squared with a color factor. But it's a different log because, of course, you know it has to go to zero in the limit that this B mu coupling goes to zero. It turns out, if you just calculate it, you know, move to mass spaces for these phis, this is the log. Or in the limit the B mu is a little bit small, it goes like this. You lose the log divergence and you just get a ratio of scales, which can suppress your diagram. So that's sort of the difference. You might have worried. The top to charm ratio is being generated two loops with a two loop factor, and I said that was very good. That actually worked quite well, very close to order one there, just exactly a two loop factor. Well, look, the B tau is not that much heavier than the charm, right? So how did I generate this big a factor, so close to a two loop factor from just one loop diagram? And it really comes down to this difference. This is a, you know, suppression just a factor of a few, I'll imagine, but the log is a factor of a few enhancements, so you're already starting to talk. Just happens to be, this is just a somewhat different loop diagram, essentially. Also, if you remember the color factors I showed you, the color factor for this diagram is a little bit small. So it turns out this very naturally generates, again, with picking order one couplings here at each of these vertices, actually very close to one, this naturally generates exactly this pattern, where the B tau is about 10 to the minus 2, even though the charm top is about 3, 10 to the minus 3. So that's nice. That's sort of a success of this. Now what about the others? So what about these ratios here? Just focus for a second on this on the quark sector. I'll talk about the leptons in a second. So you can see there's a nice splitting between the top and the charm, almost exactly the same splitting between the charm and the up. And there's a decent splitting between the B and the strange, with a decent error bar. But it's not quite as big, you can probably see, as between the top and the charm. So roughly my pattern is working, but how about, you know, in the details? To explain this, I just used that same two-loop diagram I had on the previous page to estimate it roughly. Actually, really, we calculated all the z's and then rediagonalized the kinetic terms and put them in vkawas. It turns out I need couplings. These are now also, so now once you have all these, you can solve. There's about almost exactly as many parameters as there are predictions. Actually, there are exactly as many parameters as there are predictions. So these are locked down. You don't have a, I should say as observables, you don't have an exact prediction, but each one of these doesn't have any freedom, really. So it's actually, it's a fairly constrained model. And you can see they had to come out, well, especially this one had to come out to be a little bit high. So it's a little bit worrying to me, a little bit, you know, annoying. This is essentially what's accounting for the fact that the strange is a little bit heavier, relatively, than the charm. It's not ridiculous. It was really, first of all, you know, I have dropped some order one effects, like finite parts, which can contribute. I didn't do the full running. But this is a little frustratingly high. It's better with the 45s, not too surprisingly. There's bigger color factors, more states running around. So these are really, you know, more what I'd call order one. Okay, but so roughly, of course, they are roughly coming out to be order one, and we are roughly getting the pattern we predict. And now what about the lightest generation? Well, you'll notice the lightest generation is all around the same level. And of course, that's exactly what Planck's law is supposed to be generating. This is a Yukawa coupling around 10 to the minus 5 or 6. Interestingly close, kind of funny coincidence to Gutta-Percy-Planck squared. Planck's law is sort of generating a floor for all of these ups, downs, and leptons, which doesn't allow the down on the electron. They might like to be a little lighter, right, because they're sort of shifted downwards. But Planck's law is generating this floor, so it could even be nice, depending on your point of view. In any case, one way or another, in this model, I do have it, and this is very natural. This is very close to the scale you'd predict.
Are you good scale masses?
Yes, sorry, I should have said. These are all, so the B and the tau are almost equal. In fact, the B is slightly lighter than the tau because I've run it up to the gut scale. Or actually, this is someone else ran it up for two-loop and threshold corrections. That actually is another important point, though. All these runnings have been done most carefully in the MSSM and the standard model. I'm really working in SplitSUSY. There isn't that much difference between the MSSM and the standard model or between SplitSUSY. But at the order one level, it can, you know, at the really detailed level, this could start to matter. So it would be nice if someone would do a full two-loop with threshold correction study of SplitSUSY. But now, okay. And I should also have said, these same numbers also fit all the CKM angles. So that's kind of nice. We kind of expected it because we were getting these mixing angles at intermediate order, but they do work. So now I've talked about the ups and the down quarks, and we know roughly the leptons, well, they're supposed to be equal in SU5, right? So what about SU5 breaking effects? And especially, you know, remember the mu strange has a, you know, pretty big, roughly equal, but. Well, just talk in the minimal model for a second, where these phis are really Higgses. I said there was this explicit SU5 breaking at the vertex there, because these are really just the triplet Higgses, the colored triplet Higgses. Well, this then tells you, if you remember those two diagrams, what tau to b you get. You get exactly tau over b is 3/2. And this is now an exact prediction. This doesn't depend on the fact that I didn't calculate the finite piece of this diagram, because the diagram is the same. It's just the color factors that are different. That's part of why I calculated the color factors carefully. It's in fact easy to see why it's 3/2. If it's the B quark on the outside, it's got one color, so only two more colors can run around in the loop. That's two. If it's the tau lepton, it's got no colors, all three colors can run around the loop, so you get a factor of 3/2. Now, interestingly, there's sort of this lore that B tau unification works very well, but this is close to one. It turns out this value is actually often preferred over one. In fact, just starting to see, with the most detail we can get and careful calculations, a slight problem that these authors have noted with one. Well, you know, Stewart et al. Were working to show that you could get one, but they had to work. I mean, they had to choose exactly the right threshold corrections, SUSY spectrum, etc. If you did naive scans, 3/2 is even a little bit better. In fact, in this paper, they say 3/2 in their abstract. They have a different model that generates it, but anyway, so just sort of an interesting prediction. This is the sort of thing that, well, you could even get better. Now, okay, that's for the third generation. What about the second generation? So now this diagram becomes this effective vertex here, and I have some two-loop correction generating the new strange masses. And of course, this diagram inside of it, I haven't put in any SU5 breaking yet, so it'll exhibit this 3/2 factor. The interesting thing is the one other diagram that dominantly contributes to the mu strange mass, it's totally not obvious, but when you calculate the color factor laboriously for this three-loop diagram, you again get exactly a factor of 3/2, remembering that this can only be the triplet. So this again implies a mu over strange of order 3/2. So that does not work perfectly. You know, it's close, but it does not work within error bars. So how could you fix it? Well, if you imagine then some order one mass splittings between the components of phi, in this case between the doublet and the triplet, or in the 45 between all the different components, it turns out if you look, for example, if you just look at the color factors for these diagrams, if they're exchanging fives, if you sort of decouple the triplets, if you just make the triplets a little bit heavier than the doublets, which you probably want anyway, you have there's some kind of funny cancellations going into the color factors of these diagrams. So you had some component piece of the diagram is much bigger than some other component piece, but they cancel partially. So it turns out if you decouple the triplets, that goes just in the right direction to push up the mu mass and to leave the strange mass where it is, more or less. So the color factor for one of these diagrams was 3, and then it goes up to, 5 or something. So it's pretty easy with some order 1 splitting the masses to get a mu over strange of order 3. So you can accommodate it. I don't want to claim it's clearly not a sharp prediction. I mean, I didn't have to have it. But it's kind of interesting, this is a different sort of SU5 breaking effect than we're used to. People normally, in fact, just remember, how you normally get mu over strange of order 3. Georgi Jarlskog, for example, is the classic example. You pick some new, 126 dimensional representation for the Higgs, some new Higgs, then you choose that it only couples to the second generation. You just have to choose that because you don't want to screw up B tau. To me, that was a little less believable. I just have all the same field, and kind of the mechanism that's generating flavor itself gives some splitting and can even give the right splitting. Okay, so those are all the Yukawa couplings, and those all work quite well, but they are, of course, all postdictions. I don't have any real problem with that. A nice simple explanation of the numbers that already exist is fine, just because they're already measured. But, of course, it would be really nice, we'd really like to have predictions from this model. And first, let's see, I just want to mention very briefly, I took Split-Suzy of the gut scale, so this will be somewhat unrelated to the flavor mechanism, but Split-Suzy of the gut scale predicts a very long-lived gluino. It has to decay through the squark, and the squark is heavy, so you get a lifetime which is around the age of the universe, could easily be longer than the age of the universe. This actually can be bad in some sense, but this might give you cosmological problems. After all, if this thing is stable on a cosmological scale, they've looked for strongly interacting dark matter. They've looked for this bound into heavy elements like heavy hydrogen. There are, however, a couple caveats with that. In fact, I wrote a paper talking about limits on these gluinos. So there are, however, a couple caveats, which is the strongly interacting, so we know, for example, strongly interacting dark matter is ruled out. But this gluino will not have an abundance equal to the dark matter abundance. The perturbative abundance is close, but once you go up to the QCD phase transition, we believe, though it's really difficult to calculate, that the annihilation cross-section for gluinos goes way up. You drastically reduce the relic abundance of gluinos, certainly at least by a couple orders of magnitude. And this may well be able to evade these strongly interacting dark matter search bounds. They're not extremely deep in abundance. Also, the heavy element searches have always, for a long time, had very serious questions. For example, the strictest bounds come from heavy hydrogen, where they scooped up water from the surface of the ocean, essentially. Would you really expect your heavy thing to be floating on the surface of the ocean? It's not clear. There are reasons. The entire Earth's core is made of iron, for example. Heavy things tend to sink. So those are extremely tight bounds, but it's not clear how to actually apply them to the relic abundance of some colored particle that's just sitting around in the universe. However, if this is a problem, by the way, you can always avoid this either with a slightly faster decay, so it's not cosmologically long-lived. Essentially, just make the gluino a little bit heavier. You can see it scales rapidly with the gluino mass, or a low reheating temperature, which is okay. So then, what signatures do we get? Well, I said we have this long-lived gluino. That's some strongly produced particle since it's colored. It can leave charge tracks at the LHC. We were discussing a little bit how you might look for that. Split-Suzy predicts, just like the MSSM predicts the Higgs mass, all you do is RG evolve that prediction, essentially, from the Suzy boundary condition to the high scale. Turns out, in this model I'm talking about, the Higgs mass is really predicted to be within 150 to 155 GeV. That's a sharp prediction, and you may have heard recently the Tevatron excluded down to 160 GeV by looking at WW channel. So this is actually getting close. We were quite interested to see just how far they went. So this means this can be tested very soon, either at the LHC or even possibly the Tevatron, and can easily rule out the model. Now, none of these are specific to the flavor structure, though. They are coming about because I was using a split SUSY framework. The one, and of course, you know, this is a high-scale flavor model, so it does suffer from the usual problem. It's very hard to test. It's hard to look for. The Yukawa couplings are the things which are sensitive to those high scales. The one other probe we have is looking for proton decay. These would cause dimension 6 proton decay. And the nice thing is, what you're measuring, if you can see that dimension 6 proton decay, what you're measuring are exactly the M spurion, the things that are giving rise to flavor. That is exactly also the proton decay mode. And so instead of, for example, seeing it suppressed by Yukawa couplings, those are all arbitrary order 1 numbers. That means, you know, as a simple example, it probably goes democratically to pions and kaons and mu's and e's. It's different from the normal proton decay signatures. And the nice thing is it's directly probing the source of flavor in the standard model. Okay, so unfortunately, of course, those will be really all the signatures since it's a high-scale flavor model. So just to say, kind of to summarize this model, you know, what I liked about it, we generated all the hierarchy in all three generations from arbitrary order 1 numbers. We didn't choose generations. We didn't use some Georgi-Yaloskog mechanism. We naturally generated all radiatively, generating one at each successive order. You had kind of an interesting new source of SU5 breaking effects. You didn't have to invent these, you know, higher dimensional Higgs representations. They might even change B-tau unification in a very interesting way. And they certainly affect the lighter generations even more because it comes in through loops than they affect the third. This, in fact, was really, like I said, a little more general than just the specific model I used. I mean, the general spurion like idea I gave at the beginning is really kind of a more general idea. For example, we have some ideas how to realize this in a low-scale flavor generation model. Of course, one has to bear in mind low-scale flavor may be very difficult to do. I mean, the B factories and stuff have made it very hard to avoid those experimental constraints. But we also have some ideas for realizing this in extra dimensions. There's really no reason this is tied to a radiative mechanism. For example, the size of the spurion might not be set by a loop factor, but now might be set by the size of the extra dimension. And we have some thoughts in that direction I'd be very interested to talk about. Also, and this is sort of really just a hope or a guess, you know, maybe it gives some new possibility for understanding standard model flavor in these stringy constructions which actually give rise to the MSSM or the standard model. You know, I was just talking with Stuart Robbie last week. You know, they do these big searches for all the different string vacua, looking for ones that look like supersymmetry, look like the standard model. But to some extent, you see what you're looking for, right? I mean, the way he imagines explaining flavor is in his models, for example, with some Froege-Nielsen mechanism, some bunch of ratios of VEVs that get very complicated. But, you know, that's because that's essentially what he was looking for. People also talk about wave function overlaps. So I just, you know, wonder if such a model like this might be useful to kind of change how we might imagine flavor coming out of a more fundamental UV theory. So, thank you.
You didn't mention the neutrinos error.
Yeah, sorry, I meant to say. In the specific model I showed, the neutrinos would come about in the exact same seesaw way. It turns out, I didn't show you explicitly, but the U1 symmetries that I need to forbid the Yukawas and such can still easily allow a seesaw mechanism. So they allow some right-handed neutrino mass, and they allow some right-handed neutrino Yukawa coupling. So the only prediction then for my philosophy would be, you know, okay, these are all supposed to be order 1, so you just get some anarchy, some anarchic neutrino mass matrix, which is the standard prediction of just, you know, an order 1 seesaw, an order 1 Yukawa coupling. I looked a little bit to see if you could actually get a similar kind of domino mechanism acting on neutrinos. It wasn't obvious. I didn't find any good models that really gave interesting predictions for the neutrino masses. So here, the only prediction would be just the standard prediction of anarchy.
So is it many more parameters, or I mean?
Oh, what happens in the standard? I mean, the standard seesaw mechanism is a lot more parameters. Yes. To explain the neutrino masses, you have some HLN, right?
And
these are arbitrary. So this is a 3x3 matrix, and then you have some mass matrix for the neutrinos. and ij, and this is arbitrary. So you have two more 3x3 matrices, completely arbitrary parameters. These are just allowed, and this is the standard way of generating neutrino masses. And these are just allowed in my model, or can just be allowed. And so they just then generate. So, in fact, that's really the problem, is that there are two of these. I could generate some funny Yukawa matrix here, some anarchic, you know, with this domino mechanism. But if these are arbitrary anyway, it completely destroys the predictions. The coupling just comes from integrating out this n. So
it's not uncomfortable mixing the large.
It happens totally naturally. In fact, the weird thing might be theta 1 3 is kind of small. But that's the usual problem with seesaw. It happens totally naturally because, you know, my philosophy is that everything that's allowed should just be there at order 1. So this should be there at order 1, this should be there at order 1. You just get completely arbitrary mixings and masses at the normal seesaw scale, yeah.
Yeah, I was hoping
to get some interesting predictions for neutrinos out of this, but this seems to be what's allowed.
Any further questions? So could you just say a little bit more about your CKM predictions? You said that
Okay.
It worked out beautifully.
Oh, good.
Having measured a number of these in my lifetime, uh-huh. I'd like to hear a little bit more.
Right. No, I mean, we spent a lot more time thinking about this, but I don't have really time to discuss it. But, sorry. Let's see. The central idea is just the mixing angles do come in at something like, they come in somewhere between 1 and the ratio of the masses. So like the 2-3 mixing is somewhere between, it's actually close to the 2-3 mass ratio. The 1-2 mixing is about the square root of the 1-2 mass ratio. These mixings can arise the wave function normalizations that I was showing in the beginning. So these diagrams are there. They cause off-diagonal mixing between the 10-3 and 10-2, and they cause it at a reasonably large level. If it was just these diagrams also cause off-diagonal mixing, they would cause it at too small a level, essentially because the mixing angles that come in would then be order epsilon squared here. And you can think that makes very little contribution to the determinant, for example, because it has to be multiplied by this other epsilon. And just in general, it doesn't give a big enough mixing. In fact, one of the crucial things that was giving a big enough mixing are these new diagrams. These only contribute at this level to the 10-5 bar. They don't contribute to the 10-10. So this one, for example, is a two-loop mixing between the third and second generations, and it turns out to be quite large. So the crucial thing that this did, this rotated the 10-5 bar matrix differently than it rotated the 10-10 matrix. It didn't rotate the 10-10 matrix. All those wave function normalizations, they all acted on the 10-10 and 10-5 bar more or less the same. The color factors were a little bit different between 10s and 5 bars, between ups and down quarks. But they more or less rotated the up quark matrix the same direction they rotated the down quark matrix, which means when you rotate it back, to put it in mass basis, the CKM angles actually turned out to be rather small. And it was really crucial effects of diagrams like this that were just acting on the 10-5 bar sector alone that gave you your CKM angle that you wanted at some order epsilon, roughly. In fact, when I showed you these... let's see if I can find it again. When I showed you these parameters here, I'll just talk about a two-generation model for the second and third generations here. That's what I'm showing. These parameters fit not just the mass ratios here. The mass ratios, they're really only two mass ratios. The top is fixed already, so there's really just the top to charm and the top to bottom mass ratios. So there's only two parameters. So you might have thought I had some one-parameter family of these solutions that would have fit. You might have thought I had freedom. Of course, what's coming in the Ryrie quoted actual numbers here is because I'm also fixing the 2-3 mixing angle in the CKM matrix. And that really is what's driving this coupling to be a little bit large, it turns out. Essentially because that doesn't... That comes in with products of couplings which are not that different from the products of couplings that determine the B mass to begin with. I haven't shown you, but these do in fact fit the CKM angle.
Just sort of what level of
precision.
Oh, okay, okay.
Just to give me a sense of what you're talking about.
So when I mean fit, so because I do have one free parameter per observation, I mean I can put it right on the CKM angle, 0.04 for the 2-3 mixing angle, for example. I think that's right up to the high scale. Actually, it's more or less the same. So these I really can't choose to put right on the CKM mixing angle and right on the B mass within errors, right on the charm mass within errors.
So it's really the whole pattern that is really a test of your theory, rather than any given number.
Exactly.
You need to characterize how well the whole.
Good.
Per chi-squared for degree of freedom type of
yeah, thing. Fair enough. Absolutely. That's right. Exactly. That's why I didn't sort of quote one CKM angle, say, you know, okay, I generate 0.04 within experimental uncertainties, you know, because that I can do for sure. No, it's generating the whole pattern simply, and I haven't done, tried to do some survey of parameter space where I throw points randomly and see what things look like. I wouldn't even be sure what's a good metric sort of in that space. But really what I'm more interested in is the qualitative statement, that CKM mixing angles turn out to be small. First of all, the things aren't maximally mixed, because I didn't just generate all the things at the same order. They turn out to be small, but they're by no means are they very small. I didn't accidentally forbid them or something like we were doing at some of our early models. That's sort of the best statement I can make, I think. I mean, it's no stronger than that. In other words, I can't claim more success than that. Yeah, and that is an important point, that it's really the pattern. It's not the exact numbers, because I do have enough parameters, you know. It's, you know, these parameters also, I should say, these parameters are locked down. I mean, I'm not, even the 4 makes me uncomfortable. I really did want them to be close to order 1. So what's really telling me that the pattern is working is when these numbers come out to be close to order 1. You know, with arbitrary numbers, if I could take this to be, you know, 100 or 10 to the minus 5, of course I could fit anything with any model. But 100 is not even perturbative, so I wouldn't even be able to trust my formula. And you know, specifically what I'm not allowing in my philosophy is something that gets too small or too large. So the ultimate check is when I do fit the numbers exactly, how close are these to 1, essentially? That's what's telling you how well the philosophy is working, how well the pattern is coming out.
Okay, thank you.